I've always valued the Senate. I've always valued the idea of there being independent parliamentary checks. I didn't expect this vacancy to present itself, and when it did, I thought, actually, I think I can do this job.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I am the host of this show. This week, a conversation with Scott Ryan. He is the new Senate president. Now, it's true, we really don't think very much about presiding officers in the parliament very much unless their behaviour is so egregious we really can't ignore it. But they really are important to the functioning of the parliament as an institution. Now, political tragics will know, of course, that Tony Smith has won a lot of respect in the House of Representatives for playing a straight bat in that, chamber, which was important to him after the controversies of the Bronwyn Bishop and Peter Slipper periods. So is Scott Ryan up for playing it straight too? Have a listen. Let's find out. So, Scott Ryan, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Catherine.
So let's start this conversation with the obvious. So why does a still youthful frontbencher in a government decide to step sideways to become a Senate president? It's not a normal trajectory, so why did you do it?
Look, it's not common, but I have to say it's one of the questions I get asked more in this building than outside. I think it's fair to say politics, institutions generally are going through a period of challenge in the modern world. I think these jobs are very important. I've always valued them. I've always valued the institution of the Senate. And when the unexpected vacancy occurred with Stephen Parry's departure, a couple of people spoke to me and I gave it some thought, and it's something I thought I could do well.
So nothing to do, because obviously you had some health problems earlier in the year. Some, you know, people have written up that you're deserting Malcolm Turnbull in his moment of need. You know, there's been all kinds of theories advanced.
If you believe everything written about you, you'd be very depressed in politics, Catherine. Not by you, I hasten to add, but by others. These are important roles. I've always valued the Senate. I used to teach a bit of politics at university as a tutor. I've always valued the idea of there being independent parliamentary checks. I didn't expect this vacancy to present itself, and when it did, I thought, actually, I think I can do this job well. And I might say I had achieved a lot in the previous role. We've done our expenses reforms, we've done our travel expenses reforms, we've got new regulations coming out, we've got some world-leading laws in place on authorisations to try and stop what might be happening with fake ads in other countries. And that role is actually, in some ways, not a bad preparation for a presiding officer role, because you spend so much time dealing with the pressures of members of parliament and colleagues. And also, you know, the reputational issues.
Well, what about, I want to think about when you ascended to the chair. You know, you won the ballot, you came into the chamber first day, up you go into the chair. You made a short speech in which you said to your colleagues that you had sort of, you'd now departed the executive and now you were a servant of the Senate. Now, that's a very quaint thing to say, Scott, but what does that actually mean?
Well, what it means is I no longer represent the government, and that is the ministry and the decisions that are contestable within the parliament. I now represent 76 senators, or the institution of the Senate, and by being their servant, I am effectively the mouthpiece of the Senate. I don't participate in debates in the chamber anymore, which is, you know, one of the restrictions on the role. But I was trying to indicate then that because there have been previous ministers who have served as presidents of the Senate and presiding officers, but at least with my recollection, no one had done what I had done, which is depart one to the other and win a ballot of their colleagues and in the Senate. So I just wanted to make it clear to my Senate colleagues that I know the decision that's just been taken. I know that I'm no longer a member of the executive. I'm no longer, you know, in that sense, a partisan player in the day-to-day debates of politics.
Well, sticking with partisan players, it's a neat segue, actually, into the next thought. Your Victorian colleague and friend Tony Smith has won quite a lot of accolades in the other place for playing a very straight bat. I think myself, just in 20 years in the building, the best presiding officers are the ones that are able to take off their partisan hat and do the job. Are you ready to take off your partisan hat?
Absolutely. Just on a couple of regular media things that I used to do, I've stopped doing because it's not appropriate, in my view, for a presiding officer to partake in the day-to-day partisan political debates. It is slightly different in the Senate, because in the House, the Speaker only has a casting vote in the case of a tie. In the Senate, the President does not have a casting vote. They only have a normal vote.
Yeah, you vote in every vote.
So you vote in every division unless you choose to abstain. So to that extent, you don't completely step back from the day-to-day voting in the chamber, which is one expression of partisan difference. And the Senate presidents have never, as in my knowledge, vacated the party room. But it does mean that your public presentation and the way you involve what you do publicly does change, because you have to deal with all 76 senators and, of course, now a larger crossbench than has historically been the case as well.
Mm. And let's think about what the role is, because a lot of people, I think a lot of listeners wouldn't really have a clue what the Senate President does except seeing you fleetingly on the television in the middle of a question time session or whatever else. What does the role actually involve?
Well, firstly, one of the things you learn, especially in the first week I had, where the House wasn't sitting, so there was a lot more attention on the Senate, was the surprising number of people that email you about the conduct of the Senate with tips, advice, comments, queries. So there are quite a few more people than you might expect who might watch. That's the main public element. You also effectively, along with the Speaker, you jointly oversee the operations of Parliament. And that's a large enterprise. There are a couple of thousand people who work here. There's hundreds of people that fly in and out. You have to ensure everything from the maintenance of a very expensive but intense building is maintained to security issues, which have been the subject of some public commentary we generally don't talk about. And then you also have a role, particularly in the Senate, because I'm not as familiar with the internal procedures of the House, of ensuring that, when issues arise around privilege or the operation of Senate committees, that you can essentially find a way path through with the representatives of all voices in the Senate, leaders of parties, leaders of minor parties, independent and crossbench senators, to make sure the system keeps working.
Mm-hmm. And so you don't have a casting vote like the like the Speaker in the House does. I gather, in just prepping for this conversation, I had a look at some historical stuff, and I gather that presidents back in the distant past actually participated in debates sometimes, but that's quite a long time ago, I gather. It's obviously not contemporary practice. I haven't noticed it in my time in Parliament. Would that be difficult in terms of the partisan hat issue? Would it be difficult if you were actually
participating? Well, I'll be honest. One of the questions I've yet to had time to ask, having last week being about Parliament and getting through, is what happens on conscience vote or free vote legislation. Now, the standing ruling is the Senate, the President must be in the chair if they're in the chamber. So I didn't know about that in the long past. I've been here coming up on 9.5 years, and I've never seen a President participate in debate other than to make a valedictory speech on departure. Or I think there has been an example where there was parliamentary legislation like that was being presented by the Speaker and the President jointly. They did actually do that themselves from the chair. But in general, what I'll call day-to-day political debate or issues debate or legislative debate, I've never seen it. But I will be asking the question about, what happens when there's a non-party debate, so to speak. It doesn't mean it's not contentious.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah,
but it does mean it's non-party. So
yes, like you mean in conscience votes and so forth.
So I'm not entirely sure about that. And honestly, it's one of my questions to ask this week. I think the rationale for the Senate President not having a casting vote is, of course, that each state was given equal numbers of senators. And to give the senator a casting vote, President, a casting vote as well as a deliberative vote would therefore give a state an extra vote.
Yes.
Or to deprive the Senate President of a deliberative vote would deprive a state of a vote. So that's the historic rationale for the difference in arrangements between the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And what about standing orders and so on? I remember when Pauline Hanson pulled her, I will say, to save you commenting on it, her atrocious burqa stunt, my recollection is Stephen Parry ordered a review of the standing orders as to dress, for instance, in the chamber. Any idea where that process is up to?
I'm being briefed on that later this week. It's one of the questions I asked. There's a whole range of issues that have come up in the last year that I've asked about. But I wasn't following in such close detail as a minister, so I will be looking into the report on that and whether it's been concluded. The difference with the House and the Senate is, of course, that in the normal course of events, the House Speaker represents a majority of the House of Representatives. Apart from 3 years in the last 30, the Senate President has not represented a majority of the Senate. And so I think one of the differences is that your authority in the Senate is always a bit more by consent than by imposed authority from the chair.
Mm-hmm. And we started the conversation with an observation of yours that parliaments, the institutions have come under pressure in recent times.
I think that applies to institutions right across society and the economy.
Mm, absolutely. So let's unpack that a bit. What do you mean by that? I know what I would mean by that. What do you mean by it?
Well, I just look at metrics I see, whether they be commercial surveys, market research, academic research, that shows the classic phrase, the declining level of trust. And I've always personally thought that trust is important to compromise. So I don't think it's unique to politics. I think we could see it right across, whether it's big business, courts, you know, other institutions, media even. So I don't think I'm sort of, you know, saying something profound by making that observation. What the drivers are, look, there are plenty of people that write. I wouldn't claim to have the answer.
But you think by adopting a presiding officer role in the parliament, you can play a constructive role. How? By playing it straight down the bat and repairing a bit of trust, perhaps. That's not a reflection, I mean, on Stephen Parry, obviously, who was you know, straight down the line kind of character. Yeah. But I'm trying to unpack your own thoughts about what's the value in being a presiding officer at this point in time.
I think the important thing about these bodies is that they are institutions where we resolve differences, priorities, conflicts. And we send people from all around the country with very different backgrounds, experiences, identities, walks of life, and we ask them to resolve conflicts that either the public can't resolve because mass groups are hard to resolve trade-offs, or that there needs to be an area of expertise, something like biosecurity, for example, something where some real technical expertise is important as well. And I think our parliaments all work better, or all our institutions work better, and people are more accepting of the results when there is a greater level of trust in them. I'm not claiming that I can
single-handedly fix this up.
I'm not anything like that. And one of the things I will say about Stephen Parry is, upon his departure, one of the things every group in the Senate reflected upon was how strong and impartial a president he was. So that is something I think I can almost I aspire to live up to have that sort of reputation. And I think I can do that. But sometimes with institutions, when they're under pressure, it's important to realise that we don't always understand how strong they are until we miss them.
Yeah, until suddenly.
And I don't think there's any threat of that. I think the Senate's a permanent feature of the Australian political landscape. But it does represent different sorts of constituencies in the House, and this is an important distinction. So in the House of Reps, we have 150, soon to be 151 electorates, and they represent communities which are independently drawn to make sure everyone's votes weighted the same, but they are lines on maps. They are defined geographically. In the Senate, one of the things you learn as a senator is that we have communities, and senators might not have electorates, but they do have communities. You'll have experts in superannuation, agricultural policy, other aspects, education, industrial relations. They're just as much a community in many ways that those people respond to as a geographic community. They're just not defined by a line on a map. It might be someone who's passionate with experience in Indigenous affairs by like Pat Dodson. But, you know, the community and the experiences he represents, they're not just defined by a line and a map, but I don't think that makes them any less of a community of interest. Mm. And so the Senate represents people and Australians that get together just in different non-geographic forms. And I think the Senate committee system, which has historically been one of its strengths, it gives people the chance to present directly to legislators and decision makers. And, you know, you do read the reports as a minister. You sometimes go back to read ones of 10 years ago, as I've done, looking at parliamentary expenses in a past life. And I think that's a really important role of the Senate.
Mm. And what about the cultural differences? I know you've never been a member of the lower house, so, you know, to some extent your observations will be a bit abstract. But the cultures between the two chambers are quite different. And you're talking about preserving the sort of institutional mores of the Senate. What is it about the culture of the Senate that you'd like to preserve as distinct from the House? Because I'd tell you what has put this into my mind. Obviously, that first week you spent in the chamber, you were very much tested by colleagues, which you may have expected. But obviously, the culture of the Senate in that week, when a lot of people were watching, was performative, like the House is. The Senate's not always like that. So what do you think about the two cultures in the place?
Well, firstly, there's half as many people in the Senate. So, you know, it is a different chamber by virtue of that, that there's only 76 people. There's always roughly double that in the House of Representatives. I think the other thing is that senators do tend to spend more time with one another across parties, particularly through the Senate committee system. Ministers don't get to do it, but shadow ministers, crossbenchers and backbenchers in government. You do tend to, in my experience, travel a lot more because committees meet right around the country, and that's a particular challenge I know at the moment. So, look, I don't know if I want to say what I'd want to preserve, because even in my 10 years, it has evolved a bit. You know, there's a larger crossbench now than there was when I first got elected nearly 10 years ago. So there is a difference. You know, I'll let others judge. Difference to me doesn't mean one's better or one's not.
No, what it
means is that we have a bicameral legislature. We have two chambers. People get two votes. They're constituted differently. They represent communities and views and experiences and identities structured in different ways. I have my own views. Others have different views, but it's not for me to promulgate my own views so much anymore. And I think they both play a valuable role, because there are issues, you know, when you look at regional economic disadvantage, where a geographic definition can be critical. But then there are others which may not be so geographically defined, you know, such as experiences in education or health or industrial relations, that aren't defined solely by a line on a map. And I think our parliament's richer. Our parliament is unique in the sense that we have one of the stronger upper chambers in the world, more power than the House of Lords or the Canadian Senate. New Zealand got rid of theirs. And so you do tend to get different voices expressed in different ways in the two different chambers.
What about the sort of traditional role of the Senate being the state's, you know, representative of the states, right? We've talked about that, obviously, the sort of prevailing definition of a senator is not geographical area in the way that the House is, but obviously the traditional composition of the Senate is sort of representing states and states' rights. What do you think about that in the modern era?
I've always challenged that notion. One of the things that our founding fathers, as they were, did when they wrote the Constitution in the 1890s is that they consciously made it not like the American one, because at that point, the American Constitution essentially said senators were elected by state legislatures, state parliaments. We consciously made the decision to have them directly chosen by the people, a phrase that's been of some note in recent months, of course.
Yeah.
And so that's a key difference. I've never thought that the Senate necessarily represents the states. It represents the people of the states. And that's an important distinction, because the interests of the Victorian Parliament or the Victorian government may well be different to the interests of the Victorian people, just in the way that people vote differently between the House and the Senate. They can vote differently at state and federal polls. So when people say it's a state's house, I think we've got to be careful to actually qualify that by saying, no, it represents the people grouped together as states. In my experience, in my 9.5 years here, it doesn't operate the way a lot of the founding fathers intended. That said, quite a few of them knew it was going to end up as a party house pretty quickly, because they'd seen what had happened elsewhere. But at least in the major parties that I've seen, and in my side of politics, in my experience, the fact that they come representing states actually does impact debate. They do bring those experiences with them. They do bring those particular insights or reflections coming from their communities with them. And so it may not be representing a state's house in the way some think it should. I never thought that was an accurate, you know,
reading of
the way it was constructed. But I do think it matters, and it does tend to matter inside internal party debates.
In what way?
Well, just in my experience, you know, across committees with dealing with other parties when I was on the backbench and in my own party, I've seen senators from major parties, you know, sort of fight for the perspective of the people of their state. You know, it just might not be in the public US Senate style, going to bat for your state above all else.
Yes. Yeah, I see the distinction.
Yeah.
And we'll just end on this. there's a view that there's too many inquiries going on at the present time, that the senators are too stretched, that a lot of this, the process of committee inquiry has become, one, there's too much of it going on, two, it's about partisan point scoring rather than trying to narrow points of difference. So this is a perspective I hear variously around the Senate. What do you think about that?
Well, this is a classic case where it's not for me to make a judgment personally. I'm the voice of the Senate. The Senate determines what committees get set up, what gets referred to committees, and whether select committees for specific issues are created in addition to the normal references and legislative committee work and the joint standing committee work. So it's not for me to express a view on that. You're right to say it is a view that has been expressed to me. I think the Senate committee system is one of its strengths. I mean, I've learned an enormous amount going around on Senate committees and met people and learnt about things and the impact of government policy in a way that I wouldn't ever have learnt given my particular background, you know, born in Brisbane, raised in Melbourne. So it's not for me to express a view on that. What I will say, though, is that I think if people jumped on the website, and your listeners are probably other people who do look at Senate committees and make submissions as well, you'll see there's a lot of quirk going on. I think that's both an opportunity for people to have their voice heard on a whole range of issues, but I do think I always keep an eye on the workload on both senators and staff, partly a reflection of the past roles I've had.
Mm. Okay. Well, Scott Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, I always say it, subscribe if you like the listening, and do tell your mates. Now, don't forget too, while we're on reminders, track down our still newish Common Ground podcast. It's in the political space too, and it's very much worth your time. Now, thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni and to David Constable, who produce this show every week. And I'll be back next week.